This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 27th of July 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to edition 264 of the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck.
Coming up on today's programme, we'll meet the Irish crime novelist whose music agency represents everyone from Tom Waits and Elvis Costello to Lisa Ekdahl. He's here to tell us about his new book, The Lonesome Heart is Angry, and why it strikes a tone more literary than criminal.
Then Sir Jonathan Mills is the outgoing director of the Edinburgh International Festival. He'll join us to explain his legacy running one of the world's most popular festivals of performing arts.
And later in the show, Nigerian filmmaker and photographer Tom Sate is on an epic road trip from Lagos to Sarajevo with eight other African artists. He'll join us live from Dakar to tell us how it's all been going.
All that plus some great music too, all coming up on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. So I've done quite a bit of sunbathing this week. How about you, Andrew?
It's very hot in London.
It's been really nice. My two favourite features this week, the two leitmotifs, if you will, have been the nice Scandinavian reclining chairs in the Midori House garden and battling with the accounts department over the air conditioning.
Yeah, well, that, not because they're worried about paying for it. They just like to have the
they like to have it on. And yeah. Weirdly, it's a sort of strange. I thought we might be a microclimate on the first floor. They're on the third floor of Midori House. I thought, anyway.
I've liked the ice cream runs. Of an afternoon.
But what I'm thinking is, if people are listening to this, then maybe we can set up a petition.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's not cause too much trouble, because the accounts department do pay your wages as well.
There is that.
Let's leave them alone. I think maybe we should move on with the show, actually.
I'm picking the wrong fight. I'm always picking the wrong fight, aren't I, Andrew?
That's not wise. We like the windows however they like them.
Yeah.
Good.
Well, I've got everything's all mixed up on my bits of paper.
Well, up next. Okay. I'm going to tell you what's up.
Okay, good.
Tom Edwards is going to come here with the news preview.
Ladies and gentlemen, please make yourselves at home. It's Sunday. It's midday. Live from London, this is the Monocle Weekly. And with his look ahead to the week's events, here's Tom Edwards.
Yeah.
Boing.
It's like going to the Big Top.
It is, isn't it? I know. I feel like I should be wearing a red frock coat.
How are you feeling?
Pretty good. I love stopping by at Midori House just of a Sunday lunchtime.
How's the face?
Catch up with you guys.
How are the crown jewels?
Little. Yeah. Are you discussing my footballing prowess this week, Andrew? I played pretty well by all accounts.
I hear Tom Reynolds took you. He took you as his. Well, he's a young chap who's just joined us. He let you go and play football with him, didn't he?
In the big boys' game.
You got smacked about. Yeah.
In the course of play, I wasn't being sort of bullied or anything. It's important people know that. Yeah. Took a bit of a direct and heavy blow to the face. But, you know.
And where else? Anywhere else?
No.
No?
Yeah, no. It was actually quite good getting struck in the face, as I mentioned to you, because it distracted me from the agonising pain where the previous one had struck me. So there we are. It's a physical game. It's a physical game.
It's certainly a physical game. And you play it none more physically than Tom Edwards.
Exactly. A very, very aggressive player. A lot of industry on the field of play.
What
as well.
If we've just had the World Cup, so our listeners will be pretty familiar with a lot of the big names in it. Which team were you most like, and which player were you most like?
Which
in that
player?
Team?
I don't know if people were watching in the final when there was a German player, and it was his big moment, came on the pitch, and then immediately got knocked out and had to go off.
Oh, yeah.
That would have been me.
Okay.
But yeah, and I think maybe, you know, the Germans. Very efficient. A footballing machine.
Yeah.
All the component parts moving slickly with one another. let's start with a couple of things. So, obviously, 2014, 100 years since 1914, the start of the World War One. There's been all sorts of different commemorations, all this kind of thing. And actually, tomorrow, on Monday, it's the very day, the 28th of July, of course, 100 years on. And, you know, it's not one of those times, I think, you know, people obviously reflecting and remembering. I just think it's interesting to sort of mark the occasion, remember the gravity, remember the numbers, remember the lives that were involved in the way that people had to adapt. Especially at the beginning, there was all of this sort of false optimism about how things were going to progress.
We'll be having time for Christmas.
Well, exactly, the old misnomer. And of course, there'll be all sorts of things. There's all kinds of things happening in the media, political leaders that are, you know, coming together to mark it. Sober thoughts, but I think important, nevertheless, to to remember, particularly on these poignant days themselves.
And in the UK, at least, there have been lots of kind of good things, haven't there? I mean, the BBC have kind of come up trumps, I think, on this as well. There's been some sort of good dramatisations. That sort of 28 Days to War thing.
Well, really absolutely. And I think one of the things people have been very acutely aware of is that, you know, the voices, you know, by definition, 100 years on, you know, the voices are now lost. And so that authenticity, we're still lucky enough that, well, unlucky in some respects, but lucky in some ways, where we have a lot of first-hand accounts of World War II, you know, what people actually did, the heroism. World War One, it's important to perhaps, yeah, put these things into people's collective memories, because the actual people, obviously, are no longer here to tell their stories.
Thanks, Tom.
That was a good...
It was a bit sobering, wasn't it?
No, that was good. That was a nice opening item with built-in Dolce et Decorum Est.
Like it. Other things tomorrow, the end of Eid, of course, the end of Ramadan. Just a big international event. I think it's important to, you know, check these off my list. Rather, a bit of a checklist this week. Not a lot of detail, but just have to go through a few.
Yeah, okay.
Then I've got some few slightly more upbeat. But
if you were finishing Ramadan, what would be the first thing you'd eat?
I would probably go for some kind of classic pie.
Okay. Yeah, okay.
It's a little bit wintry, isn't it?
You're a little bit like our art director who doesn't like sweet things. So on his birthday, didn't want a cake. He wanted a pie.
I say, well done.
So you made him a huge pork pie with 40 candles in it.
Absolutely, yep. Right. You can't celebrate more than you can with a pork pie.
No.
I'm not sure about that.
Okay.
Now, you know, I also like animals, both to consume them in pies, but also in their natural habitat.
Yeah.
International Tiger Day on Tuesday. I love a tiger.
Tiger pie?
Okay. No, you can't eat them. You mustn't. Okay. This was all began in 2010, of course, the St. Petersburg Tiger Summit. I wasn't invited. I don't know why.
Do they all fly in from around the world?
Different tigers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fancy checking in next to one of those in the seat.
Imagine.
Who are you?
Be like, oh, God, look at him.
Oh, God.
Stop licking me.
This guy's going to be chatting the whole way.
Frosties for breakfast again.
Another one of these important things to remember, you know, our animal brethren, tigers. We need to do more for them.
And so the Siberian tiger is one of the most beautiful and most endangered of all of them, isn't
exactly.
It? It's up there with the Bengal tiger.
But I think almost all of the tiger populations are under, you know, they're on the sort of serious threat level. It's always in red on those little maps.
Yeah.
Just in Las Vegas, numbers are growing.
That's the only place. Yeah, they've been having to give up some because they're getting a little aggressive. Where should we go now? Do you want a serious thing or a ridiculous thing?
A ridiculous thing, please.
Okay, so I've got two left. They're both probably equally ridiculous. On Friday, it's the start of International Clown Week.
Oh, that's a terrifying thing.
Do you know there's a sort of a network of an international network of clowns, but the actual formalised week to celebrate them, do you know who first sort of encouraged them to do it? It was out of the USA, and to sort of recognise them and sort of
Charlie Chaplin
anoint the week. A bit later, but kind of equally comedic, political figure.
Ronald Reagan.
Richard Nixon.
It was Richard Nixon. So
brilliant.
International Clown Week was first recognised, some may say appropriately, by Tricky Dicky himself.
Wow.
I mean, Tricky Dicky is almost like a clown name, isn't it?
Yeah.
Or Tricky Dick, was he? I can't remember.
Tricky Dicky.
Never liked clowns.
No, they're not funny, but they're all spooky.
What about terrifying, though? What about the sad clown? I'm always suspicious of the sad clown.
Yeah, clowns don't do it for me.
You know what they say about a man with big shoes, Andrew?
Huh?
Bucket of glitter. Well, I've got one of those cars where the doors and windows fall off.
The tiny cars. What's that about? Why do they travel like that?
Tiny cars, big feet.
It's impractical at the best of times. The little tiny bikes they ride as well. With the big shoe. I don't know. It's lost on me.
Yeah.
And then let's finish with this. This is my favourite. And I should point out, I'm usually quite protective of the diary for the weekly items, the news items, you know. I've been influenced by our producer, Daniel Giacopelli, who drew my attention to this event. On Wednesday it begins. Strap in for this. It's the annual Rock Creek Lodge Testicle Festival. Wait till I get into the detail of this. It takes place in Clinton, Montana. 5 days and nights of wild, sexy, naked fun. They promise that you'll have a ball. I mean,
end up with only one.
I can't. Some of the things in there, the events.
I literally don't understand what that means.
It's a celebration of all things testicle.
But men's.
Men's.
Not just cows. No.
Well, cows feature. We'll get to it. So you can enter the big balls contest. Who has the biggest and best? Their sexy lady judges decide. There's also a ball eating contest, and these are bull balls, and it's
goat's balls or something.
Four bulls.
Oh, bull balls.
And they're pretty big. 4 minutes to consume as many as possible.
What is this? Is this like a testicular cancer awareness thing or
something? No, it's done not to raise money for any charities.
Specifically, if you try to get sponsored,
I think it would be,
will throw you out in the snow.
Daniel Giacopelli was very keen to show me some of the promotional images, and I can't think of any charities necessarily that want to ally themselves.
I think it's time we took that computer out of your room.
Now, can I ask, are you entering the most bruised ones?
I could do. Maybe they would feature, because it's an array of light and shade. Bluest balls. Maybe I should suggest that as a new subcategory for this year's edition. I think I would definitely. Yeah, I don't really know what to say. I was kind of speechless when Daniel told me about that.
Speechless when you took the direct hit.
No, exactly. Well, no, I made more of a kind of pained noise, sort of a small. Yeah, like the air coming out of something. I did ask Daniel Jacopelli why he was perusing that website and why he was so keen for me to raise this, and he didn't provide any further information.
Okay, well, say we're sending him to report live.
I'm ready. I'm ready to sign that one off.
Nice one. Well, I think we've run the gamut there. I know we've included the First World War, Ramadan, and the Montana Testicle Festival.
Exactly. Never let it be said that we don't have all of the different sort of light and shade of world news, Rob.
It's a broad church, if indeed it is any sort of religious temple.
I think whatever church it was, we'd probably all be excommunicated by.
Exactly. Or be made priests.
In fact, it's probably positive.
It's so bad. Exactly. Yeah. Tom, thank you very much for this week's
Have a good rest of the show.
Thank you. Our first guest today is writer, novelist and music agent Paul Charles. We'll get to the music agent part in just a bit, but Paul's new book is The Lonesome Heart is Angry. It's published by New Ireland and it's out on the 4th of August. The book is set in Northern Ireland, where Paul is from, and the action is focused on a matchmaker in a small town.
Paul has written a dozen works of crime fiction and also a fictionalised biography of the Beatles called The First of the True Believers, which takes us to his passion and career in music. In the day, Paul's a music agent and a rather busy one. He's half of the Asgard agency, which he set up and represents household names in the music industry, Tom Waits, Nick Lowe, Elvis Costello, The Kinks and many others.
Paul, welcome to the show.
Pleasure. Thank you very much.
And first, let's deal with the new novel. It's written about what sounds like it might be home. But how close to home is it? It's a small town, Northern Ireland.
Yeah, it's a fictitious town called Castle Martin, which is in fact set about 3 miles from where I grew up, a village called Macrofelt, which is on the shores of Loch Ness. And it's set in the late 50s, early 60s, when matchmaking was still...
Our protagonist is a matchmaker.
Yes, yeah.
And this is obviously something. I mean, the sort of sexual politics of Ireland are an interesting thing, right? This is what the novel explores.
No, totally. And also at that time, it was either exploding, or it was being contained. It was you both extremes. The kind of younger people that were going to younger universities and like were kind of seeing the other side of life, whereas they were still coming home to these very religious dark houses that would be totally monitored by their parents and kind of kept under control by their parents. But the story kind of starts off with a set of twins, Pat and Joe Kane, and they go into the matchmaker and they make this strange request to the matchmaker in that they both are looking for a wife, but it's the same wife they're looking for.
Yeah.
And as a result of that, the kind of story goes on, and something bad may or may not have happened. But it's as much how the locals, the gossips, deal with what they think happened and what they think might have happened, and how that impacts the life of the matchmaker and his family and the life of the twins out on the farm.
Well, Paul, you're obviously somebody who took themselves out of Northern Ireland, but that's that claustrophobic sense of the gossip and people knowing people's business. Was that very real, and is it still really alive, do you think, in Northern Ireland?
Well, at that time, I was living in a small village and I was paying my way through college by being a messenger boy. And in the course of the evenings and Saturday, you would kind of go around all the houses. You'd bring the message, they'd invite you into the house and they would start to talk as if you weren't there. They'd offer you a cup of tea, they'd be unpacking the message. But you would hear all the gossip, stuff you weren't meant to hear about, stuff you weren't meant to even understand, but it was all there. And I don't think it's the same now, because even that village, the real village, it's a kind of different community now. It's not a tight a community. There was one point when I was growing up is that everybody in Marafeld would have known everybody else. That's no longer happened. It's a much, much bigger village now. And there's lots of different communities. And there's TV and there's videos and there's games and there's sports and there's whatever. So it's no longer the main event. I mean, in those days, you may have one TV on every street, but not on every house. You wouldn't have a telephone on every house. So it was kind of, gossiping was really the big part of the entertainment. And the other part of the entertainment was the oncoming sexual revolution.
And can you sort of balance both the sort of pros and cons of gossip? Because there's a protective element to gossip, which is obviously what gossips might say they're doing with talking about it. And obviously there's the prurient side of it. I mean, I guess both of these sides are dealt with in the book.
No, totally. And they're both equally valid. I mean, you know, without the gossips, some things would be allowed to lie. Some things would be allowed to stay hidden, you know. But at the same time, if it's malicious gossip, then it can and did really ruin people's lives, you know, as entirely.
And we should say, there's a crime hinted at here. This is not a traditional crime thriller, is it? You're more in the literary world rather than the crime world with this novel.
Yeah. Well, again, I wanted to write a story whereby you start with the characters before the crime, if it happened. If you know what I mean. So in most people's lives, they're going on with their lives. And they go through their days and their months and their years, and then they reach this point. And at this point, they're involved in a crime of some kind, either as a participant or as a victim or whatever. And I kind of wanted to take the story from before that point, from really just being aware of people's lives and their interaction and how they were connecting with people. And the other big thing I wanted to try and do as well is I wanted to put a couple. They're both kind of like 29, 30 years old man and woman. I wanted to put them together and put them in the middle of all of this and see if they could get through this with their love intact at the end of it. Or would the gossiping and would all these scenarios, would it impact it negatively?
I mean, I want to pick up on what Andrew said there. The idea of this as being a piece of literary fiction rather than a genre novel, because I know you're right, the Christie Kennedy series is obviously, they're thrillers, they're murder mystery thrillers, and that's a different thing. Do you know when you've got the characters maybe, it sounds like you write the characters before the plot perhaps, do you know therefore that this novel goes in a different direction and that it doesn't fit into this nice, neat genre that some of your other novels do?
Well, I was intrigued by the whole art of matchmaking. As I was growing up, you would hear about it. And you would hear all these weird and wonderful stories about, you know, a 19-year-old girl wanting to be matched with a 90-year-old farmer, you know, or two sisters wanting to be matched with two brothers.
Yeah.
Or, you know, far randy farmers who would happily pay the 10 bob to the matchmaker to be able to go out on a date with a young woman, you know, and not really looking for anything more than that. So I was kind of trying to work out, I think it started off that maybe, in fact, the original title for the book was The Matchmaker, and it was maybe going to be more about the matchmaker. But then, as happens, I write the story pretty much as a reader. I go into the story each day to find out what's going to happen. I mean, I know that sounds weird, but that's really the way I go about it, the same way I go about the detective stories. I really go into those stories as a detective, and you work your way through it, and you kind of you go up. No, that doesn't work. You backtrack, you go up and you check out different clues or whatever. It was the same with this. It was like, it was originally going to be about matchmaking, but then I kind of thought that ends up, well, once you've told the story of matchmaking, there's no real book, there's no real story. So, but in the middle of this came this thing about, well, what would they have been asked to do that maybe would have not have been the normal? And how would that all have been dealt with?
Can I ask you about the mechanics of doing this? Because we're about to touch on another part of your life. You're certainly a busy man in your other career. How do you balance, you know, getting a novel out, which is a huge commitment, and especially something that's literary and is as involved in this? And yeah, there's an element of research as well you have to do. Are you somebody who just gets up at 4 o'clock and writes? Or do you go away for a couple of months and write? How do you manage to pull the two things off?
Well, actually, it's a lot easier than you think, because if I'm working on the first draft of a story, I will religiously go to it each day at 6:30 till 9:30. And I will work on it. And again, for me, it's important with the first draft that you kind of keep on top of it. So that's how I managed to do it. And then, you know, after that, you go in the office and you put on your other hat and you start to do your other work. And I feel I'm a kind of writer that maybe that's as much as good writing I could do in a day. Even I had 6 hours. I'm not sure it would be a productive 6 hours. I think that those 3 hours, first thing in the morning, when your brain's fresh, when the day is new, when there's no distractions, I think that's, for me, when it's magic and when it feels great.
Yeah, it's a fascinating thing. I think some writers have said this, musicians say this as well, that, you know, what's the point in spending 15-hour day in the studio when you know you can nail it in two? That's the thing.
Yeah.
The Lonesome Heart is Angry is the name of the book. Tell you what that sounds like, a Nick Lowe song.
Right.
Doesn't it? That sounds like something off The Convincer.
Maybe you could pitch it to him.
Yeah, that's all right. And let's turn to this. I mean, this, what started first? Managing groups? Actually, I know what started first. I think you started managing groups out of a telephone box.
Yes,
right? When you were 15.
When I was 15. Yeah. I was managing a bunch of mates. You know.
Yeah. So that wasn't, I love the fact that a rock manager, music manager, with all that stuff, with these legendary names on your roster, it's like, this isn't enough, I need to start writing
right.
a lot of books that you're exceptionally prolific as well.
Well, again, it's one of those things you kind of, probably the same as yourselves, it's something that you just slip into, you know, that you realise it was part of your dream, part of what you wanted to do. But like, even in the, you know, when I was managing the band, I was kind of writing lyrics for them, I'd be doing their biographies. When I came over to London first, I would go to, like, down to the Marquee Club and see Taste and Rory Gallagher and try and interview him and do a review and stuff like that. So I was kind of doing that, not really as wanting to be a writer or anything, just because it was something I could do and I was returning favours and stuff, you know. And then you kind of go from there. I became a big fan of British detective fiction and a big collector of books in that area. And you, again, I just went through this process of not really ever thinking, I want to write a book. I thought, if I did that, what would my detective be like? So I started to think of this guy, Christy Kennedy. And I would, and again, at this point, there was no thoughts of writing a book, but I just went along with the flow of that. And I thought about him and kind of, okay, well, I would do this. I would, you know, Irish guy, Ulster man, strong, you know. And then before I knew it, I'd started to write a book. And I hadn't thought of, I want to get a book published. I just thought, okay, this is something that feels really, really magic. Because when you're in that space of writing, to me, there's nothing like it. I mean, it really is a beautiful, wonderful feeling. It's just so, so precious. And I just enjoyed it and I did it. And then, you know, it kind of went from there into getting the Kennedy published. And before you know it, there's a few of them.
But as Rob hinted there, do you think there is a crossover with the people you represent? Because, you know, Tom Waits, Nick Lowe, Elvis Costello, certainly an appreciation amongst them of language.
There's some great lyricists.
Yeah. When you sit down with them, do you think that's been a little bit of a bond, even if it's an unspoken bond?
Well, I mean, again, I think of songwriters as being great storytellers as well. The genius they have, unlike me, I've got at least 250 pages. They may have six verses if they're very lucky. But some of Nick Lowe's songs are so visual, so they just take you into the story. Tom Waits, you know, I mean, you just listen to Tom Waits, and he takes you somewhere. You know, like great storytellers, you don't think about the writing, you don't think about the lyrics, the length of them, the beat of them, the rhythm of them. You just think of the story, of the visions, and you're pulled into it and you're captured into it. And, you know, we were talking about this the other day, Van Morrison, Astor Weeks. To me, it's just a wonderful, wonderful collection of short stories.
Yeah.
I mean, probably one of the best collection of short stories ever released. And that, to me, that's all. Obviously, the music helps you kind of go over that thing with some people to make it kind of eat into your brain. You know, some people kind of just, the melody catches them and they're living with the melody and they're living with the hook. And then one day they realise, oh my goodness, that's such a wonderful, clean, beautiful line. And it's, that's great imagery.
But it's an interesting thing. I mean, I guess you've written about Ireland, you know, you've written about Northern Ireland. You haven't written, it's always, I guess, the temptation for anyone that sort of made it in music to, it's an addictive place to be. You've taken yourself very much out of that to write these books, by the sound of it, right?
Well, I mean, again, maybe,
I wonder how conscious that is.
Well, maybe and maybe not. I mean, again, you know, Kennedy is an Ulster man living in London. There's a lot of the kind of, there's a lot of the imagery still there of this one. We've kind of gone back to it, you know. And again, I think that, you know, a lot of people, a lot of Irish writers write about the magic of Ireland. But I think you have to be outside of that magic bubble and that area and that community to be able to observe it properly and to see it properly and to have, you know, to have those kind of feelings about it.
And we should also, we've also got, I know that the Blue Nile's on your roster.
Oh, yes.
So obviously, you know the obvious question, when on earth are they going to release a new record?
Well, actually, believe it or not, sooner than you think.
Oh, well, that's good news.
No, Paul is in the studio at the minute working on a new piece of work. So the way I always look at it is, you know, the longer it gets away from the release of the last record, the closer it's getting to the release of the next one.
Yeah. That's what I like about it. Now, he's not a man that gets up at 6.30 until 9.30, presumably.
He's probably, I would imagine, probably not a man that goes to bed ever, you know. I mean, the imagery and the walk across the rooftops, that's just,
that's more storytelling.
Yeah, it is. And beautiful storytelling.
Paul, how lovely to have you on the show. Thank you so much for coming in. That was Paul Charles, author of the new book, The Lonesome Heart is Angry, out on August 4th. Thank you.
Brilliant. Thank you very much.
Should we have a little bit of music, Andrew?
Please.
Well, we're going to keep it on a Nick Lowe tip to satisfy okay. Paul, Charles, and myself, and probably yourself, and probably the listening several. Let's have this is an oldie, but a goodie. This is Nick Lowe with "I Love the Sound of Breaking Glass." I love the sound of breaking glass, especially when I'm lonely. I need the noises of destruction. And that was "I Love the Sound of Breaking Glass" from Nick Lowe, which happens also to be the name of Paul Charles's first Christie Kennedy detective novel back in 1997. You see what I've done there?
Clever. Well, he did it before you, actually.
Yeah, but I noticed it.
Okay.
You're listening to Monocle 24, broadcasting from Midori House at 1 Dorset Street, London, W1. Monocle 24 is a wholly owned subsidiary of Wynn Content and is edited by Tyler Brulé and Andrew Tuck. With bureaus in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Zurich and New York, Monocle 24 has over 50 editors and correspondents filing for us around the clock. If you have any editorial, distribution or advertising queries, please email us at info@monocle.com. Monocle. Keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
So Jonathan Mills wasn't a sir 1 year ago. He first heard the good news via a telephone call and he was halfway around the world in New Zealand. He received his knighthood last October, so you can say he's had a pretty good year. In context, the realisation that his time leading one of the world's most famous arts festivals is near its end might not be so terrible.
Sir Jonathan has been director of the Edinburgh International Festival since 2006 and is due to step down at the end of 2014. He was handed the gig at Edinburgh following artistic directorship roles at the top festivals in Melbourne and Brisbane. And of course, there's the music. Sir Jonathan is a rather prolific composer with operas, a ballet, concertos and many more to his name.
And Jonathan joins us now to explain his legacy at Edinburgh and what life post-festival might look like. Jonathan, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. You're sort of going out the exit door. That's a bit of a shame. How do you judge a success at such a kind of multifarious, multi-stranded thing such as the Edinburgh Festival?
I think one way of judging success is not to hang around too long, actually.
Right.
Not to stay when people are asking the question, is he still here? But also, more realistically, it's for others to judge success. And so that's for others to comment on, not me. What I've tried to do during my period at the Edinburgh International Festival is to engage with ideas that are very much about the arts, but beyond the arts as well. Because I think if we have a conversation that is about things in which we experience the world, the way we think about the design of the world, the way in which we think about the political shifts of the world, the demographic shifts of the world, the fact that, for example, between the time that my predecessor arrived at the festival and the time I arrived, there was no World Wide Web. The human genome had not been mapped. And China and India had not yet emerged as major economic forces. So seismic things like that are things that we need to take account of and start to think about, well, how does culture respond to this? How does this have an impact in the way that we think about the cultural space, the way in which artists will reflect narratives, stories, the way we write music, the way we tell stories, sing songs, make dance, make pictures, make films, and so forth? It all plays into a way of telling our story in the world, not as it was or as we might like to think of it in a nostalgic sense, but the way that the world evolves in its endlessly curious way.
Listeners can't see my face, but it has a, well, that's told me.
Jonathan, just let me ask you, you've got people listening all around the world, just explain to them the size and the remit these days of the festival. So we know obviously at its heart is the theatre festival, but it seems to encompass everything from comedy to visual arts, from TV. How much of that falls under your remit? Yeah. And just explain to us what your role really is there.
Okay. So in 1947, when there was still food and petrol rationing, a bunch of people thought hard and fast about what would they do in the wreckage after the Second World War. And I think in such existential moments, people tend to not think about statistics or finance, about economics, about how we measure things, but how we feel. What gives us a measure of confidence? What can we share? And it's the things that we share in these moments that become palpable and essential. And in 1947, in the worst of times, for the very best of reasons, this little festival started. A few people thought they should have been invited to the official festival, and they weren't, so they started their own party, the Fringe. A few years later, a few people thought, hey, we live in the world of cinema, and we live in the world of ideas, books. We live in the world of television. We live in a multicultural world, a Mela. And so all of these festivals started to emerge, till, as of today, or about to happen in a few weeks' time, there are 8 festivals in Edinburgh in August simultaneously. And these 8 festivals between them are what people refer to as the Edinburgh Festival. I'm responsible for the originating festival, the Edinburgh International Festival, which once upon a time it was all about traditional arts. What it does now is it's about scale. So everyone thinks that the Fringe is huge. I think of it as prolific, because it's a proliferation of lots of little things, like the biggest ant's nest you've ever seen. I mean, amazingly energetic, and I love it. But what I do is not so prolific, but it's very large scale. So on average, a very large performance for the Fringe would be 10 people on stage. That's very small for me. We've got one of our performances this year with, if I add what's under the stage, in other words, the orchestra performing, and on stage, 350 people. A 5-hour epic opera about the Trojan Wars, you know. What's great about Edinburgh is that all of these things in a loose coalition that's highly sophisticated. So it's like the grandest cultural buffet you've ever had. There is something for everyone there. And you come to Edinburgh and you will celebrate with 25,000 artists, 40,000 individual performances, 5,000 discrete productions, 350 venues. Some of them would be no bigger than this room. And we're in a little studio, by the way, for those who can't see us, in London. And it's mad, and it shouldn't work, and it defies every kind of management orthodoxy. But the reality is, it does work. Why? Because at the heart of it is something very simple, a simple truth about people wanting to share and share perspectives of the world and share knowledge of the world that is not only their own. And I think in that generous spirit that was started in 1947, something very profound was built. And off the back of that, of course, these festivals go from strength to strength.
And does that same spirit pervade? I mean, presumably the quality of that spirit has changed. It's now become this habit-forming thing. And I wonder also whether the Fringe, when it started up, and these different satellite festivals to your own, have kind of done you a favour, or has done the International Festival a favour. You can be your avant-garde self with the help of the splashy stuff on the side sometimes, perhaps.
There's no doubt that we don't have to do everything.
Yeah.
And I think that's a benefit to every festival. I mean, it's a benefit to the book festival. It doesn't have to be everything. But altogether, we pack a punch, as it were.
Yeah. I can ask you, you have a summit that runs alongside the festival now, and that's something to do with, you know, soft power. I think that we talk about a huge amount here at Monocle. We have a soft power survey every year. It comes at a very, very interesting moment, obviously, for Scotland. You know, you're an international festival. You're an Australian originally running an international festival. But this is a festival also does reflect Scotland. And this is a point at which Scotland is about to decide whether it should be an independent country. Do you feel the ebbs and flows of that debate getting caught up in the festival, getting caught up in what you're doing, that there's an ambition for you to represent a certain kind of Scottishness or to be emblematic of what a Scotland could be, for example?
It's a very interesting question and a quite complex one. First of all, the summit. The summit was started 2 years ago in the aftermath of the Olympic Games. I felt that at a time when Britain was welcoming the world, quite literally the world, to the Olympic Games in London, and then there was that wonderful cultural festival attached to the Olympic Games, of which the festivals were part, I felt it was important to welcome the cultural ministers to the busiest cultural location in the world, Edinburgh, in August, and to ask them questions about themselves, learn their perspectives, and start to have a formal dialogue for the things that we've done informally in a quite ad hoc way, by welcoming people from all over the world, by having artists from some 80 or 90 different nations in town, in Edinburgh, in August. What does that mean? What does that mean for how they value culture as opposed to how we value culture? How they define their identity and how they advocate for themselves, how they protect and promote their own cultural values and areas of cultural diversity. And to have this in a conversation that is not instead of or in a way separate from questions of identity and value of Scotland or Scottishness or British or English or Britishness and so forth. And so I think that the notion of an international conversation requires you to delve deep into your own values. It's not a rejection of your own values. In fact, it's a reinforcement in some ways. You can't have a conversation with someone else at that level unless you really know who you are.
So it's important to know what Scottishness, for example, means.
Absolutely, and it will change and it will evolve. What Scottishness meant in 1947 will be radically different from what it is today. What I would say is that in all of the debates and the discussions that I've been having, and especially the conversations I've been having with Scottish ministers, there is no sense in which they are not highly ambitious for Scotland, no matter what happens on the 18th of September, to remain very, very in tune with an international conversation. So this is very appropriate for an international festival in a context where the government is very ambitious for Scotland as an independent or as a part of a nation, as that will be decided, to continue these conversations. And, of course, it is borne out in history. How many things of the modern world that we take for granted, like the lights in this studio, invented by a Scotsman, James Clerk Maxwell, the tyres that you drive on, invented by a Scotsman, Dunlop. I mean, the modern world of economics, first described by Adam Smith, moral philosophy, the whole notion of our civic society, described by David Hume. So Scotland has always been connected to international ideas and current ideas. Nothing different in that. So there's a Brigadoon view of Scotland, but there is also the view that I take, which is an enlightened nation that has made a huge impact globally in transforming the world that we know.
And in terms of the summit, I'm interested in it's obviously got a very different fibre to it, to the festival as a whole. Can it do, in inverted commas, as much as an international audience sitting in Edinburgh and watching an amazing performance together?
But my answer to you is not so much that, and I think it's a fair question, is what can they do together? Meaning that how more powerful is it that as all of those audiences in Edinburgh are doing and appreciating and conversing and exchanging ideas, how powerful is it to have the people who are making decisions, who have power, who are making decisions on behalf of their citizens, coming and witnessing that and seeing what they could do, what ambitions they could have for their own festivals, but also having a conversation about the very issues that are at the heart of an international event like an Edinburgh festival.
Now, we should be encouraging people to come to the festival. Tell us one or two of the highlights this year that you think that will be, you know, standouts.
I think no doubt that the trilogy of new plays from Rona Munro, which is a collaboration between the National Theatre of Scotland and the National Theatre of Great Britain will be a highlight. These are three biographies of the lives of James I, James II and James III of Scotland. Now, at one level, I can hear people saying, who are they? You know, kings of Scotland from the mists of time. Well, if you want an idea of what Scotland and England is today, go to see these plays because they're very contemporary in their continuing relevance. Rona is a great playwright, and what she's done is she's created very vivid drama that speaks to a contemporary audience but tells the story about how this relationship between England and Scotland is very fraught and very challenged from hundreds of years ago, let alone at the moment. So that's an absolute highlight for me of everything that we're doing this year in Edinburgh, and very relevant to the debates and the discussions that will happen between now and the 18th of September.
Well, Jonathan, thank you very much for talking us through it. The summit, we wish luck. The Edinburgh Festival, we know, doesn't need it. Thank you very much for your time.
Great pleasure.
The Globalist provides insight and analysis of the key news and business stories in Europe and the Middle East. Informed, engaging and authoritative, it's a 60-minute bulletin of news, features and opinion. Two presenters in London are joined by guests in our studio and all around the world, including Monocle's editors and friends in our Hong Kong and Tokyo bureau.
Monocle's Asia editor-at-large, Kenji Hall, joins us now from Tokyo. Can you explain a little bit about this turnaround in price?
The Globalist also features an extended daily newspaper review with a special guest here in Midori House.
They're claiming that these are going to be the most compact games of all time.
And of course, we round up the business headlines with an expert analyst in a key city. Plus, don't forget the Daily Monologue, an op-ed piece from one of Monocle's globe-trotting editors. From the sublime to the occasionally ever so slightly ridiculous, find out what the minds inside Midori House are thinking. All that and more every weekday at 6 a.m. London time on The Globalist.
Monocle has shops around the world selling our exclusive collaborations with some of our favourite designers, including Ettinger, Porter, Barenna, Jawbone, Oliver Peoples, and many more. You can find us on College Street in Toronto, Hudson and Charles in New York, and in the heart of Wan Chai in Hong Kong, and two in London. So, whether you're after a versatile travelling wardrobe, something for the home, or a present for a loved one, or just missing back issues from your collection, you're sure to find something at the Monocle shop.
Nine African artists are currently on the first half of a road trip of epic proportions. Lagos to Sarajevo in 151 days, and it's a journey that encompasses 21 countries. The participants are photographers, writers, videographers, critics, historians and performance artists, all members of the Invisible Borders Trans-African Photography Project. This is the project's fifth road trip and the first transcontinental one.
The purpose of this trip, which began on the 2nd of June, is to stop in major cities while creating personal works and develop creative projects with local partners. Well, one of the members of this road trip is Tom Satay, a Nigerian social documentary photographer and documentary filmmaker. Tom joins us now on the road in Dakar, Senegal, where the group is temporarily based. Tom, great to have you on the show. Tell us a little bit about the idea behind what you're doing. I understand that you want to make these partnerships, but is this to highlight migration? Is it to highlight local issues? What's the big idea behind this?
Well, we're trying to address movement within Africa through this project. And we're all different artists, different visual artists, and we're working on different diverse issues in context of movement. One of the projects that I'm working on, it's on African immigrant within the African continent. So in every city we go to, I try to find immigrants from other African countries who are living in this very city, and I get to talk to them and photograph them and get to know how they got to be here. So it takes time to build relationship with these people.
And do you think the camera makes that a little bit easier, a little bit harder? Sometimes people kind of like, when you know, you've got the camera around your neck, you have to negotiate with people. But people at the end of the day kind of like being in a photograph. In your experience, going to all the places you have done and are going to go to on this trip, do you think taking pictures of people makes that negotiation any easier?
It depends on basically the people. You know, what I do most of the time is like I'm always hanging my camera around my neck and going around. And, you know, sometimes when I see something that I like to photograph, you know, I woke up to, for example, I want to photograph somebody on the streets, and I woke up to them, they don't want to be photographed. They say, oh, no, I don't want to be photographed. Or sometimes, you know, I just take a photo of them and I show it to them, and they like it and they say, okay, fine, you know, let's do it. But then sometimes people just say, oh, no, delete it. I don't want to be photographed. So it works sometimes carrying your camera around for people to see it first before you photograph them. And then sometimes, you know, it doesn't work. So it's pretty trickish.
And tell us about this this sort of caravan of artists that's traveling across the continent. That's presumably an exciting thing. Do people sort of hide behind their doorways when you roll into town, or does that kind of get these communities excited, the communities you're visiting?
Actually, that's not how we've been moving. Usually, what we've been doing is like we've not been actually going about in group, except when we're visiting galleries or institutions, or maybe visiting a particular artist in a city, then we go in group to go to these places. But usually, as I said, we're all working on different personal projects. So usually we go out, individually, or sometimes we pair ourselves, maybe two people go to a particular place. And that depends on if you guys are working on a similar topic or issue in that particular environment.
And Tom, tell us, you know, it's obviously an expensive endeavour to travel across the country, or across the continent rather, like that. How is this funded?
We've received some support from some institutions, some art institutions in Europe and locally, and also from individuals. And recently, we've been running out of funds, so we started a crowdfunding. So that's basically how, at this moment now, we're trying to get funding.
And if people want to see the work that you and your fellow artists have been producing on the road, how can they do that?
We have an app for iPhone and Android. Also, we have a website where you can go to. The website is it's app.invisible-borders.com.
And finally, just tell us, where are you looking forward most to visiting in the rest of the trip?
I've never been to Europe. So I'm looking forward to getting to Europe and do some of the stories that I want to do. I'm also exploring interracial marriage, that is Africans marrying Europeans and Europeans marrying Africans. So I'm interested in those kind of issues. So I'm really looking forward to getting into Europe and documenting these issues.
All right, Tom, well, it's fascinating stuff. Thank you very much for joining us. That was Tom Sate coming to us live from Dakar. And that's it for edition 264 of the Monocle Weekly, Andrew Tuck.
And a very nice one indeed.
So who likes Paul Charles then?
You do.
Yeah, he's pretty cool.
We both do, but that kind of touches all of your passions with music, really.
He's a button pusher.
He's a button pusher.
If we don't get some tickets to see someone august on that list, then, well...
Oh, I think the Midori House live sessions may have just jumped up a gear.
Yeah, I hope so. But I'm always amazed at people that sort of have that amazing sort of work rate that can literally cut their sort of head in two, in a sense, and be a novelist from 6:30 till 9:30, and then a band manager and an artist manager of such mega acts, presumably juggling big money, big names, you know, tops of bills, this and that, all the negotiations you need to do with that. Do those two things, and he's written, I don't know, like 15 novels.
Especially because it's an industry where people don't actually go to bed at kind of 8 o'clock in the evening, is it?
Yeah, exactly. That's the thing, yeah, because he's just like, oh, I get up, you know, when I get up at 6:30 bright and fresh, I'm like, I could name some people on your roster that might not.
anyway, that was a fine thing to meet him.
And Jonathan Mills is nice, wasn't he? He's a good. He's great at pitching his putting his stall out for Edinburgh and what happens afterwards. This summit sounds interesting.
yeah, again, interesting seeing, you know, in many senses, an outsider come in and shake something up like that and kind of really kind of make it, you know, a proper international festival. So, yeah, we've had a good day, Mr. Bound.
We have had a good day, and it's nice to go. It was nice to go slightly scratchily, but to Senegal at the end of the show. We like that, don't we?
Yes. When they said he was in Dakar, I thought he was in the car.
Anyway. That's a probably decent pun.
Yeah, there you go.
I hope Steve Wright's not retiring anytime soon, because you'll be hot on his heels on the big show on Radio 2 in the afternoon.
Thank you, buddies. Do all the big thank yous. I'll thank Daniel Giacopelli.
He produced the show.
And the man who introduced Tom Edwards to the world of the Ball Festival.
The Testy Festy.
That's correct.
Yeah. I'm going to thank Claire Urban. She was our studio manager.
And that's, I think we've got to thank
her. I'd like to thank you, Andrew Tuck.
And you, Robert Bound. Thank you.
And also, for the time being, should we thank our listeners for very much for tuning in.